I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, when did the Civil War end? We commonly say it's a fact that it was on April 9th, 1865, at Appomattox when Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered to Union General Ulysses S. Grant. And from a legal point of view, the war ended in August of 1866 when President Andrew Johnson simply declared the insurrection is at an end. Some say the Civil War never actually ended, so it's complicated. But an even more difficult question is, when did the post-Civil War peace begin? And then there is the question, when did freedom begin for those who were enslaved? These answers are elusive even to historian Michael Vorenberg. His new book is Lincoln's Peace, The Struggle to End the Civil War. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source. But first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. It was a shocking image, a photograph taken on a shocking day, a Confederate battle flag being carried through the nation's Capitol Rotunda during the January 6th insurrection. It was a painful reminder of the U.S. Civil War and how some say it never really ended. Of course, we all know from our high school history class that the Civil War ended on April 9, 1865 at Appomattox when Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered to Union General Ulysses S. Grant. But it wasn't so clear at the time that that was the end, because it actually wasn't. There was a lot more work to be done in ending the bloodiest war in American history and also establishing peace. Historian Michael Vorenberg writes about that in his new book, Lincoln's Peace, The Struggle to End the Civil War. And Michael, welcome to The Source.
Thank you, David, and thank you for having me on. It's a real pleasure.
I'm really curious, why is it important to ask this question about when the war ended, and also when did the peace begin?
Well, you just gave a history of the traditional way we think of these things, and I have to tell you that that was my way of thinking of it, and I've been teaching the Civil War for more than 20 years. So I was asking myself the same question as I was in the archives one day and came across a report that had on its title, End of the Civil War. I had sort of happened on this report by mistake. And
it was not your mistake. Let me just say that. It was the archivist. They brought you the wrong box.
They did bring me the wrong box. And I was researching something else entirely, and so I had nothing else to do, so I went looking through the box, and here's this report that said End of the Civil War. It's a thick report. And I said, well, what possibly could there be new to say about this? And then I started looking and found all these things that surprised me. And in the introduction to the show, you mentioned that there's this event on August 20th, 1866, 16 months after the Appomattox surrender, where President Andrew Johnson declares the insurrection at an end. That proclamation becomes the legal ending of the Civil War, just very strictly legal ending. The Supreme Court affirms it. I didn't know that the Supreme Court had actually affirmed that. So there are many things I didn't know. So one answer to your question is simply, complexity is interesting, and I was interested by this, but there's a much deeper answer. And the deeper answer is how we think of the ending of the Civil War defines the war for us. And that definition has not just a historical element, it has a moral element. So if we think of the ending as Lee in this gracious way surrendering at Appomattox on April 9, 1865, we get a certain picture of the South, of the Civil War, of the nation reunited rather quickly, and of peace being established right away. But if instead we, let's say we jump ahead to August 20th, 1866, and we ask ourselves, why would the president need to declare the war over? I mean, what happened in those 16 months that the president felt he needed to intervene and declare that the war was over? A declaration, by the way, which Congress rejected. Congress said, no, we continue to say that the war continues and we have war powers to keep the Army of the United States in the South. So how you define the war then, how you define the end of the war defines the war itself. And notice in nothing I've said have I mentioned the end of slavery. And if this is a war to end slavery, which it certainly became, it might not have begun as one, but it certainly became, then why is it that we focus on these dates like Appomattox where slavery never entered the discussion, emancipation never entered the discussion between Grant and Lee? And you're in Texas and you have Juneteenth, and now Juneteenth is a national holiday. Why is it that that holiday stands as the end of slavery, but it's segregated, if you will, separated from the Civil War story? These are two different lines, and yet the end of the Civil War and the end of slavery are naturally combined. So all of these questions started going through my head in the archives, and it took me a while before I realized, okay, there's a book here, and I really jumped into it. But those questions were there from the beginning.
So going through your book, it seemed like there were multiple endings to the Civil War. There was a cultural ending, a military ending, a political ending, a popular on the ground ending for, you know, folks who are just trying to work their farms. There were people who never wanted it to end, and they continued to try to put up a fight wherever they could, whether it be Nathan Bedford Forrest or others. Why wasn't there a large-scale organized guerrilla resistance?
Well, one way to answer that question is to say there was. So part of the story of Appomattox and that surrender, April 9, 1865, is that when Lee surrenders, all Confederates lay down their arms. That's the myth that goes with it. I think a lot of people who study the Civil War know that that's not true. But there's another part of that myth, which is, well, this is not myth. This has fact behind it. So a couple days before that moment, when Lee is talking to the high command of his army, there's a proposal that they don't surrender, that Lee take his army best as he could into the mountains to the west, and that they wage a war from the mountains. They avoided calling it a guerrilla war per se, but certainly it would be a different kind of war. It would be a war not of organized fighting, organized armies, but it would be closer to a guerrilla war than the war that Lee's army had been fighting. So there's that, which is, and that proposal is rejected by Lee. So that becomes part of the myth, that Lee says, no, I won't have the war go on, and it won't happen. But in fact, for many in Lee's army, and certainly out of Lee's army, that kind of war is fought. And it's fought by the Army of Northern Virginia, by some for a few weeks, and then it's fought by others outside of that army for months. And then if you think about the rise of the Ku Klux Klan in 1866, but there are many other paramilitary groups in the South as well, and you think about what they're doing, the best way to really think of it is as insurgency, right? These are insurgent operations, and we use that word all the time in modern warfare. And we treat insurgency as a continuation of war, usually in the 21st century, is a different form. And so it's a reasonable question to ask, why don't we do the same for the American Civil War and for these insurgencies that continue into the 1860s and 1870s? So that's one way of answering the question, which is to say, well, actually, there was. And in the book, I talk a lot about the guerrilla warfare that continues and how this becomes a problem for the U.S. Army. They have to create policies to try to get guerrillas to stand down. And a lot of those policies are successful. But of course, you get a whole nother wave of insurgencies in 1866. And then in 1870s, you're going to get more insurgencies. So it's not a steady, you know, line one way or the other. It's like many wars. It has sort of fits and starts, flames that go down and then are rekindled. And I'm not saying it's that the war ever reaches the height right. and severity and massiveness of what it had been.
We're going to continue this conversation. There's a lot that we can look into and reflect on today. Historian Michael Vorenberg continues Lincoln's Peace, The Struggle to End the Civil War. Stay with us.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're having a conversation with Professor Michael Vorenberg. He is a professor of history at Brown University. He is the author of Final Freedom, The Civil War, The Abolition of Slavery, and the 13th Amendment, which used as basically as the blueprint for the Steven Spielberg movie about, you know, Lincoln and the end of the war. His new book, Lincoln's Peace, seeks to expand our understanding of the nature of war itself and how society struggled to draw the line between war and peace. So our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you want to join the conversation, you've got questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. So it's Lincoln's Peace, but Lincoln is assassinated just 5 days after the surrender of Lee?
That's correct. And I won't hold you accountable for, you know, giving away the plot. I think most people know this, but it's interesting. It's important to remember that no one knew that was coming. So for Lincoln, he obviously believes that he's going to be a part of the settlement. And the book begins with Lincoln leaving the White House and going to the front lines in Virginia. It's the longest time he'll ever leave the White House. He's gone for around 2 weeks, and he would have stayed longer, but he ends up going back to Washington. Ironically, he gets back the day that the surrender has occurred. And yes, so, and then, as you say, within a week, he's dead. He's been assassinated. When he hears about the surrender, he's overjoyed, and there's a serenade group that comes to him, and he speaks to them. And then he gives us his speech a few days later, which turns out to be his last speech. And he congratulates Lee, and he talks about the Reconstruction to come. But he never says the war's over. He never says that. And he knows that there has to be a series of steps, that there's going to be a process. There's not going to be a moment in time where you say, okay, war is over, peace has begun. So he never does that. Others speak in these terms, but Lincoln is very wise and understands that it's going to be a process.
So, but Lincoln had a vision for a peaceful reconciliation or reconstitution of the nation. He did not seek vengeance. Instead, he was promoting malice towards none, charity for all. Let us strive to bind up the nation's wounds.
Yes, and you're reading from the second inaugural, arguably one of the greatest speeches ever given by a president, and that's in early March 1865. So that's a few weeks before he leaves the White House to go to the front lines. And as you say, that message is a message of reconciliation. We don't know what Lincoln would have done. He didn't have a clearly laid out plan for Reconstruction. He had done many things, and he had certain visions, but he was flexible. And the word flexible shows up the first time he gives a proclamation about Reconstruction. That's the way he was. He was flexible and he adjusted to situations, but there were certain principles that were absolute. One principle was the destruction of slavery. That was absolute. The state, any state wanting to come back, had to prohibit slavery and swear loyalty to the Union. But another principle was this kindness to former Confederates. He worried a lot about harsh treatment of former Confederates. On the cover of the book, I use a painting called The Peacemakers, which was done in 1868. And it's a pretty famous painting. It hung in the White House for some years. It's a beautiful painting, and it's Lincoln meeting with the top generals and an admiral. The generals are Sherman and Grant. And this is a meeting that takes place on a steamboat, March 28th. He's on the front lines. And one thing he says in this meeting, when he's is to talk about the treatment of the former rebels. And he says, let him up easy. Let him up easy. So in other words, as if it's a wrestling match, you know, you've won the match. Let them up easy. Don't stick it in their face. That's his vision. And yes, so it is a reconciliatory vision. It may not have been such a realistic vision. It may not be that all Confederates were simply going to stand up, shake hands, and all would be nice. I think there Lincoln may have been in for some surprises had he lived.
He was a former wrestler, but he did, you know, under Grant, who, you know, heard this directly from Lincoln, Confederate soldiers were not imprisoned or executed. Officers and men could return home if they promised not to take up arms again. They were even allowed to bring home their horses for farming. They did have to stack up their guns, except for their sidearms. So that was considered too generous by many.
Well, it was considered too generous, especially in hindsight, if you look down the road a few weeks or months or years. At the moment, though, that it happened, I don't know if Grant came in for much criticism for doing that. It became a template, actually, what he did for all the surrenders afterwards. I should say, though, there is an important legal distinction. He never granted amnesty to Confederates. That is, he never said that they were sure that they would never stand trial. There was always the possibility, certainly for the higher officers, that they might have to stand trial for treason, for example. They were given paroles, and as these paroles gave them free pass to get home. So there was the possibility of trials, and certainly there were those, Edwin Stanton, the Secretary of War, would be the leading person, who wanted there to be trials of the high command, of the highest officers for treason, and expected there to be trials. So there then becomes this sort of failure of communication, if you will, because a lot of the former Confederates see what Grant has done as a kind of amnesty, when in fact, legally, it isn't amnesty. And yes, there could have been trials, and Stanton definitely wanted there to be trials, with Jefferson Davis being first in line if Stanton has his way.
Now, in the book, as when you write about Lincoln meeting with Grant, and they were talking, and they met with some Confederates discussing whether or not to invade Mexico together, that the Union and the Confederacy would go into Mexico. This is when Maximilian had taken over Mexico, and Mexico was also in its own civil war. What was that all about?
When I set out to write the book, I knew it was going to be a book that dealt with time, that is, these different endpoints and how they mean different things. What I didn't realize at the beginning that I wasn't just going to deal with the when of the war, but the where. And the where turns out to be just as expansive and complex. The war is in many ways a continental war, with most of it going on east of the Mississippi. To your point, when we look at the border with Mexico, let's say Texas-Mexico, that has been, if you will, a hot zone for a long time, for decades, of course. And the idea of many Americans that there should be an invasion of Mexico is not a new idea. One of the things that's new and that took place during the war is that Napoleon III, who Americans tend to call Louis Napoleon, has installed this puppet emperor named Maximilian into Mexico as the ruler and is supporting him with French troops. Benito Juarez and the Juaristas are trying to reclaim Mexico for the Mexicans. This is all going on during the war. And it gives a number of Americans, especially on the Union side, the notion maybe when the war with the Confederacy is over, there can be an invasion. We have this great army, and we can kick Maximilian and the French troops out, and we can seize some of the territory. And this notion evolves among some into this really interesting idea of a kind of, hey, that can be the invasion that also puts the end of the Civil War together. If we can create an alliance with certain Confederates and say, hey, let's put our differences aside, Confederates and Unionists, and come together and invade Mexico, everybody wins, right? And we can stop the bloody war. There's only a handful of people who think like this. One of them, for example, is Lew Wallace. Lew Wallace will go on to great fame as the author of Ben-Hur. And Wallace has this grand scheme that of the sort I just described. When we get towards Appomattox and just afterwards, Grant, this is what Grant has in mind, and others too. Sheridan has this in mind, of at the very least having a very significant size army on the Texas side of the border and just waiting for an excuse to invade and use this opportunity. So yes, that is going on at this moment as well.
During those talks with the Confederacy about a joint operation to invade Mexico, of course, Lincoln insisted that the Confederacy end, and it's one nation, not two nations, invading Mexico. And then that was, of course, non-negotiable for the Confederacy, and it fell apart. But also, wasn't there some messaging going on to the Confederacy simultaneously during these talks that that they're going to lose, the 13th Amendment is going to be ratified, and slavery will end automatically? But if they joined up together now, then they would be able to have some say in maybe a gradual reduction of slavery till it comes out of existence.
Sure. So what you're talking about now, and I think it's also what you were hinting at before, is a very specific moment. So let me be clear about what this moment is and when it is. This is what we call the Hampton Roads Peace Conference. And it takes place in very early February of 1865, while the war is still full on. And you have on the Union side, Lincoln and Secretary of State Seward. And on the Confederate side, three so-called delegates of the Confederate side. I say so-called because, as you just said, the U.S. doesn't recognize the Confederacy as a nation. So they're not going to recognize these three people as genuine envoys. The pretext for the meeting, the reason the meeting takes place, is it's set up as a discussion about some kind of joint venture to Mexico. And as you say, that initial part of the meeting in Hampton Roads, which is in Virginia, I should mention, in southeastern Virginia, that initial part of the discussion, that goes away quickly for the reason you say. Lincoln says, sure, we're willing to talk about a joint venture, but it'll be a joint venture of the United States, and you can join in, but you have got to give up this idea of the Confederacy and come back in, one nation. And at that point, the real discussion is over because the Confederacy is not going to give up on that. But they continue to discuss. They continue to have a discussion. And that's when Lincoln tells them that Congress has just passed the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery. It's gone to the states for ratification. This is news to the delegates from the Confederacy. And they'd want to know what it means for them. And so, yeah, that becomes part of the discussion. Here, the sources conflict. But one of the sources, which is a Confederate source, says that Lincoln actually said, and I'm not sure, I don't think I believe this, but Lincoln said that to Alexander Stevens, one of the Confederate delegates, look, if Georgia comes back in, Stevens was from Georgia, Georgia can basically take its time to ratify the 13th Amendment. It can do it gradually. It can do emancipation gradually. I really don't think that Lincoln would have said that, and that Stevens wrote this long after the fact to create this story. But yeah, they did talk about the 13th Amendment, and that was, but all of this is happening a few months before Appomattox, but it does show us Lincoln thinking about these things and other people thinking about these things even before Appomattox.
And also simultaneously, there was this wariness of how long would this war continue. We didn't know that it was just a few months away before we had Appomattox. We're going to take a break here. We're going to continue our discussion talking about the new book, Lincoln's Peace, The Struggle to End the Civil War. I do want to ask you about Joe Shelby and his attempt to go into Mexico. And, you know, we've been covering Shelby Park quite a bit here, and so it's interesting for us. And our phone lines are open. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can also write to us. Email at thesource@tpr.org. We'll continue our discussion with historian Michael Vornberg. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, having a conversation with historian Michael Vornberg about his new book, Lincoln's Peace, The Struggle to End the Civil War. I'm going to ask you about Joe Shelby going into Mexico in a bit. But first, I want to get to this point about when Lee surrendered to Grant at Appomattox, April 9th, 1865. You write that the Galveston newspaper said that was actually a good thing and that the war still could be won and for everyone to fight on. How did they see that as a good thing?
The Galveston paper is a wonderful source of what I call in the book, and what others have already used this term, diehard Confederacy or diehard Confederates. They refuse to give up, right? So they're looking for ways in which you could imagine that the Confederacy could still pull victory from the jaws of defeat. I should mention that even more important than what's being said in the Galveston papers is what Jefferson Davis himself is saying. So when Richmond falls on April 3rd, which is just less than a week after this April 9th surrender, that's the capital of the Confederacy. And we might think then, well, that's about the whole game if the capital of the Confederacy has surrendered. And Jeff Davis gets away with his cabinet. They get on a train and the train heads into the interior of Virginia. Davis refuses for a moment to consider that the Confederacy is over. He and the cabinet are on the car. They call it the cabinet car. And he says, this is the Confederate government. They have precious metals, gold and silver. And they say, this is the Confederate treasury. He says that. Now to your point, what Jeff Davis says publicly in a speech that's reprinted everywhere that still has working presses in the Confederacy is the following. The Confederate armed forces now is much better off because they don't have to worry about defending Richmond and Petersburg. Petersburg is the railroad hub near Richmond. So all that manpower that was used to defend those cities, now you don't have to worry about it because those cities have fallen to U.S. forces. Now those forces can focus themselves, what's left of them, on defeating U.S. armies. And so Davis says, we're actually better off. And so the Galveston papers pick up on this and say the same thing. We're better off now. Now, if you're in Galveston, especially, this kind of thing makes sense because you haven't seen U.S. troops. You're so remote. This is even more true if you go to the interior. I mean, Galveston people knew as a port city that U.S. ships could show up any moment.
And yeah, sure enough, trade hands.
They did. Yeah, exactly. And but in the interior of Texas, you know, that area, that would take, you know, I guess months to at the least before the U.S. Troops were able to penetrate into the interior of Texas. And, you know, slavery continued in the interior of Texas a long time because it could, I guess, from Confederate slaveholders' point of view, who are still in Texas.
Should be pointed out that Jefferson Davis was captured by Union forces on May 10th, 1865. I mean, things were happening quickly. The dominoes were falling. And by the end of May, General Kirby Smith surrendered his Confederate army in Galveston. So it was, things were happening quickly. But still there was this delusional reporting by these. It was a separate reality that the newspapers were reporting leading up to the war during the Texas Troubles and throughout the war. I mean, so to bring it up to looking at like the problem issues we have today is we have competing realities that people consume. And that's kind of the way it was at the time of the Civil War. The South, the people who were aligned with the Confederacy, they were consuming information that was completely different than the North.
Yeah, and there had been competing realities from the beginning, of course, with the war between the Confederates and the U.S. And I agree with what you just said, that the similarities to today are eerie, maybe a little frightening. The ways in which people seem to be living in two different realities, getting fed two different sets of facts, right? We think of this as a modern day thing tied to social media or tied to news channels that target specific audiences. But back in the 19th century, it's true the news was delivered much slower, but it wasn't so different. That is, the news targeted specific audiences. The Galveston paper you mentioned, they targeted a pro-Confederate audience. And so that audience, if that's all you read was the paper, you thought, yeah, things are just going fine and we're plugging along here. It's really too bad about Lee falling. I'll give you another example of that, is that the Confederate ship, the Shenandoah, is operating in the North Pacific. And I talk about this. It's really one of my favorite stories. And they're operating in the North Pacific. And of course, they don't get the memo about Richmond falling and Lee surrendering. They're up there in June and July of 1865. And their mission is to destroy the New England whaling fleet. And they're quite successful. They do an incredible set of damage. They begin to run into these ships who say, you know, the war is over. Richmond has fallen. And Jeff Davis has been captured, all these things. They just refuse to believe it. They say there's no way that Lee could possibly have surrendered. No way. And so that reality is the reality in which they live. It took them some time until they actually finally saw some newspaper headlines before they believed it. That kind of way in which you're dug into a certain reality is true of people who are actually on the ground as well and are hearing this news. And really on the North, it's a different kind of reality. It's a reality that just assumes that because Lee surrendered, that's it, the war's over. There's celebration all over in the cities on April 10th. And the dominant theme is, you know, the war is over. That's the headlines. That's in the book. I show an image where it says "the end," which is the headline in the New York Herald on April 10th, the day after. And yet it goes on and on, so that you don't get these other endpoints. You say in sort of like dominoes, the dominoes fall slowly, I would say, as these things go. It's not till, as you say, it's actually early June that Edmund Kirby Smith surrenders. And then the Herald has to run a whole nother headline, because they've already run a headline a few months before that says "the end." So now they write a headline that says "complete." So they have to write these multiple endings, right? Because Kirby Smith finally surrenders. By the way, Kirby Smith, he wasn't there at the surrender. It's one of the great stories. He doesn't show up. He's worried he's going to be imprisoned, maybe hanged. So now I get to return, get to where you, I think, want to go, which is talk about Joe Shelby.
Right, so Joe Kirby's Shelby in San Antonio. He's hiding out in a hotel room here.
Right, but before he gets there, right, that's exactly right. He'll end up there. He's supposed to be in Galveston surrendering. He knows that Joe Shelby and his men, the so-called Iron Brigade, have headed for Mexico. And so instead of showing up to Galveston, as you say, he heads and he's in San Antonio, and he's basically trying to save himself from capture. And he's in a hotel room and he starts to hear a band playing and blah, 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 all this noise outside of his hotel room, because Shelby's men have shown up and they've heard that the great general Kirby Smith, who is the commander of all the Trans-Mississippi forces, the Confederate general, is in the hotel room. And so they're singing and playing songs to him. And he sort of steps out and kind of blurry-eyed and say, "Oh, here you are." And now they're all together and they're going to head to Mexico. They're going to head to the border.
So Shelby, he has his Confederales, what do they call them? They're heading towards...
They eventually are going to get called the Confederados, and the Confederados would be anyone, civilian or armed people, army, who migrates to out of the Confederacy, let's say. And most of those people are going to end up in Mexico and Brazil. And the Brazilians I don't deal with in the book, but they're really interesting, and they set up colonies in Brazil. But the Mexico ones, those are very relevant, because some of them think, hey, if we can persuade Napoleon to lend us some troops, we can create some kind of army and go back across the border, cross into Texas, and take on the U.S. Army again and restart the war. Whereas the people who go to Brazil and most of the people who go to Texas most people who go to Mexico, like Brazil, they know that things are done. They're setting up colonies. They're done. But there are these people who really think, yeah, we're going to create a new army and restart the war.
And in Brazil, they still have pockets of folks who celebrate the Confederacy, I guess with like Gone with the Wind typed events.
Yes, they celebrate Robert E. Lee's birthday. In there's a couple towns. Americana is one of the names of the towns, which quite appropriate, right? So, where they celebrate Lee's birthday, they fly the Confederate flag, as you say. It is a bit probably inspired more by Gone with the Wind than by anything like reality. But yes, that's exactly right.
So, but I'm coming up on break, and I want to have some room to really air out this point that you make in the book. But, we have Shelby and his troops. They have to put on civilian garb and they go into Mexico. It's not clear, you just can't go into Mexico with an army and expect to be welcomed there, and so they have to negotiate all that. But the fact that they are not wearing their Confederate, regalia is also interesting. But I want to get to the offer that was made to Shelby and his troops and how they turned it down and why that's important. You really lay this out really interesting. And, and I have been reporting on Shelby Park. I did a piece for NPR about the origins of the name for Shelby Park and how it's been called the graveyard of the Confederacy, and how that relates to some of the political conflicts that we've been having over immigration and who controls the border. But we'll talk about that when we come back from the break. Our phone lines are open. If you've got a question or a comment, call in 833-877-8255. The Source continues right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Historian Michael Vornberg is with us. His new book is Lincoln's Peace, The Struggle to End the Civil War. And let's go to a caller, and we have George. And George, you're on the air.
Well, tariffs seem to be a big topic now. Some people say that there's dangers of tariffs being used to start wars. I was wondering if you could talk about the tariff on cotton or the tariff of abomination kind of causing the value of cotton to go up overseas in other parts of the world. And those they're using agents to start, like, the Republican Party to kind of start the Civil War in the interest of getting the value of their cotton going up overseas, things of that sort.
All right, George, thank you for the call. So when we talk about the different endings of the Civil War, the political, the military, there's also the end of the Civil War by the view of our trading allies. But how did tariffs enter into the Civil War?
Well, I want to respond to George's question very quickly, which is the tariff crisis he's describing goes back to the late 1820s, early 1830s. In other words, about 30 years prior to the Civil War. And it is relevant. As he said, there was a tariff of abominations, as it was called, passed in the late 1820s. And South Carolina leads the way in opposing the tariff, the argument being that the tariff will lead to, it'll punish the South and in these ways of reciprocal tariffs put on by England. So yeah, there's a lot of concern about the damage tariffs will do. And the language that comes out of the South and by John C. Calhoun especially is a language against the US government for imposing high tariffs, because ultimately it's the Southern whites, not just the large cotton growers, but the consumers, that is people who buy textiles, who are gonna be hit the hardest. I think that's an important moment in terms of an identification of a Southern identity, let's say, against the US government. And Andrew Jackson stands firmly against the South at that moment. He has to back the tariffs, even though he really didn't like them that much, but he has to back them. Now you jump ahead. So the international issue and what's going on is a little different during the war. It's not so much about tariffs, but the issue of cotton, yes, is absolutely at the center. And the question is, what are England, what are France going to do? What's Spain going to do?
And these questions, these calculations of foreign countries really do tie into making bets, if you will, on which side is going to win, and which is then a real bet is how do we get cotton for the cheapest? And so if you bet on the Confederacy and the Confederacy loses, the U.S. is going to hold it against you if you're England, for example. But if the Confederacy wins, you're in a kind of most favored nation status, and you're going to get cotton for cheap from the Confederacy. So England is having this, you know, kind of internal decision-making process about which way to go. It absolutely hinges on economic issues. The more that the Confederacy seems to be losing the war, the less likely that anyone's going to come and help the Confederacy. And here's the last thing I'll say on that, which is that doesn't stop the Confederacy from still believing to the very end that Napoleon III in France is going to come to their side, and that in the end they might do so for economic reasons of cotton, let's say, that they want favored nation status around the South's cotton. But it is how the revolution was saved, right, by France. France comes in and saves the revolutionaries, and that's how the Americans win. So the Confederates' idea, it's not quite as crazy as it sounds. They talked about the revolution. They said France saved us back then in the revolution, so it's just going to happen again.
Now, with Shelby crossing into Mexico via Eagle Pass and sinking the Confederate flag in the Rio Grande along the way, that is still something that's reenacted in Eagle Pass from time to time on the anniversary. Is it July 1st? But it's also been talked about as being July 4th. Maybe this, you know, the romantic view changes the calendar a bit.
I spent a lot of time trying to figure out the day, and I don't have a definitive answer to you, because, as you say, I mean, if anyone knows, it's the folks down at Eagle Pass, right? And they say July 4th, I think, is the official one. But then again, people have challenged that and just said, you know, you're just using July 4th because it has such meaning.
Yeah, I don't think that they know, because, you know, the painting that they would have of that event that hung in their city hall for many, many decades had them, Shelby, in his Confederate garb and very, you know, very romanticized view of what happened on that day. So to the point, though, that they crossed over into Mexico, they were met by Juarez forces, and they were approached by Juarez saying that, not him directly, but his forces, that if you joined with them in their rebellion, in their fight against the French forces, that they would give the Shelby provinces. So, and what happened?
That's right. The notion all along had been this sort of that from the U.S. point of view is this danger of Confederate folks joining with Napoleon and the French. But in fact, as you just said, and I talk about this in the book, it's actually a choice that Joe Shelby and his men have, because the first people to approach them are Juaristas. And as you say, they're given an offer, and it's a very attractive offer, which is, if they will help them resecure the capital and the country for the Juaristas, they will be paid off handsomely with farmland. The question then, right, is, well, okay, if we get farmland, what about slavery? But the Juaristas are very clear on this. Mexico has abolished slavery. It's been abolished for some years. So at the end of the day, if this all plays out, the Confederates may get some nice pieces of land, but they don't get slavery. And so I talk about this because Shelby and his people are trying to figure out which side are we going to back if we back any side. Is it the Juaristas? Is it the French and Napoleon and Maximilian? And they end up, as I say, playing the long game, a really dumb game, but it's the long game of saying, you know, we're going to reject the offer of the Juaristas. We're going to go with Napoleon because we really think Napoleon more likely to win, but also he'll really give us what we want, which is land and persistence of slavery. That is, we can continue to be slaveholders. And so, as I say, they're willing to reject the offer right in front of them that really is a better offer for the fantasy. What is a fantasy of continuing the Old South as it was, but on Mexico territory? When I say the Old South, I mean with slavery included.
Yeah, but the cornerstone of slavery being essential for their purpose to fight and to even be who they are, they could not give that up.
No, they couldn't, right to the end, as you say. And the cornerstone is the word used by Alexander Stephens in the spring of 1861. Stephens is the vice president of the Confederacy at that time. And he says slavery is the cornerstone of the Confederacy. And so, as you say, to just give that up, that's a big thing to give up, even at this moment, right? Where, as you say, they're having to wear civilian garb. They've sunk the Confederate flag in the Rio Grande. So it is quite a moment.
Let's go to a caller really quickly.
And they refuse, yeah.
I'm going to get Jesse in on this. Jesse, thanks for holding on. You're on the air.
Hi, gentlemen. Yes, I just had a question. I was listening to an NPR show a while ago. And they were referencing conflicts that happened in the United States. A part of kind of like officially ending the conflict was a act of absolution, which means basically like reconciliation, everything was A-OK going forward. So I'm just trying to figure out, would the guests have more information as to why that necessarily did not occur, an act of absolution?
All right, Jesse, thank you for your call. Michael.
Yes, I it's a great question, and I want to know more about these acts of absolution. You get something close to an act of absolution in a way with under President Johnson, who will, after giving many pardons, much amnesty, gives really a blanket amnesty to all, a blanket pardon to all, I should say. It's the Christmas pardon, as it's called, in a couple of years after the war. It's not an act. That is, it's not passed by Congress. It's an executive order, I guess. It's not really called an executive order, but it is a declaration. It's the president who has pardon power. So he uses his pardon powers there to do that. There is no act of absolution. And I wonder what an act of absolution would have looked like. But I do think that that moment is often treated as an act of absolution. I also think that in many ways, the Grant accepting of Lee's surrender and giving the generous terms is often seen as an act of absolution in the cultural moment. It wasn't. It wasn't at all for the reasons I said. I don't know what an act of absolution would have looked like, because in modern day issues around transitional justice, absolution is a process. It's a process that involves both perpetrators and victims. And that's the normal way it works in international relations. Nothing like that happened in the Civil War. So there was no act of absolution. If it had simply been declared, as I guess Johnson did, it could not possibly have been effective. There had to be a process. Now, one looks to a place like Germany after World War II and what happened there. That is a long and complex process involving many stages. To essentially bring Germans out of Nazi rule and into the modern or post-World War II era, there's never an act of absolution for Nazis, to be sure. Yeah. But there's a series of steps, really.
Michael Vorenberg, his new book is Lincoln's Peace, The Struggle to End the Civil War. Michael, so good to have you on talking about this important issue. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
That's The Source. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Technical support by Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, and Yvette Benavides. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.